it's not a wish. I actually put the work in. So you can't just think that you're going to write things down and it's going to happen. God is not a genie. On the outside, we were growing. The company looked beautiful. So nobody knew that we were having financial struggles. And that was a good feeling. Everybody's telling us no. Now everybody wants you. And now you get to dictate the rules.
This is the show for ambitious, material girls who are learning how to channel their chaotic energy into a more intentional and fun life. Don't be stupid. Listen to Too Smart for This.
Welcome to Too Smart for This. I'm so happy to be chatting with you today.
Happy to be here. I am very excited that I'm on a show called Too Smart for This. So such an honor.
I'm glad. You're very smart, clearly, based on your background. So I can't wait to get into that. But I would love for our audience to just get started with hearing about your story. I've done like some research around you and your story is very fascinating. So I'm very curious. So you were a nurse for 8 years. And tell me more about how you made that decision and what it felt like to have a safe career and then jump into entrepreneurship afterwards.
Yeah, no, because they're like on two opposite ends of the spectrum, right? Being a risk taker and becoming an entrepreneur and like having a very safe position like I was in my nursing career. And it was really just that my mom encouraged me as I was growing up as a teen, when I was getting ready to make the decision to go to college and decided what career path I wanted to take. She did a very great job of, you know, drilling down the importance of having stability. And her words was recession proof. Because when I graduated high school and I was entering into college, it was actually during 9/11. 9/11 happened in 2001. I graduated high school. And there was a lot of uncertainty in the world. And my mom's whole goal was to make sure that she had a little bit of certainty, even though there's one thing that's always certain is uncertainty. But in her mind, she wanted me to have a stable career, stable job. And so she would always say, like, no matter what happens in the world, we're always going to need nurses and healthcare workers. And so that's why I decided to go into that field. Growing up, I did like science. It was like one of my favorite subjects in school. And I also loved health, like learning about like how the body works. And so it was more of an easier path for me to go into. But growing up, I've always had this passion for like the beauty space. My real passion and what I wanted to do was like, I wanted to model and I wanted to like work for hair care companies and like be that little girl that was on the box of like relaxer kits. That's what my ultimate like goal was to do.
Yeah.
But for her, it was like, this is not a normal career. Like this is the way that you should go. And so I was a kid that listened and I did exactly that. And I realized that after 8 years, it didn't even take me 8 years. I knew immediately once I stepped on the floor and was working as a nurse that this was not something that I saw myself doing for the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted to find myself because I knew that I was living my mom's dream. And, you know, I went through life and I went through, you know, a very traumatic situation that allowed me to really discover who I was because I went through loss. And when you go through tragedy and loss, you just have a different perspective on life. And I'm like, you only get one shot at life. Like, let me start living my life on my terms and not for, you know, my mom's, and no fault to her. She only did what she knew what was best. But I really wanted to step into something bigger and what I felt was purposeful for me, that was designed by God. And, you know, that's kind of how I decided to take the risk and step out on faith and start my Yale.
Well, that is a very touching story. And I want to get a little bit deeper into it as well, where you write in your book about losing your son. And that is really what triggered this experience of grief. But it also brought you closer to God. So can you tell us more about how that, I mean, my family went through something very similar and it was very difficult and still has repercussions now, but it definitely did increase our whole family's, you know, relationship with spirituality. But I'm curious, how do you hold space for both the tragedy and like the healing that you've done from it?
Yeah, you know, I feel, and I wrote about this in my book, I think that you can grieve and have peace at the same time and be purposeful at the same time. You don't have to choose one or the other. And there is no right way to grieve. So all of the books that are out, no one can actually tell you how to process something that, you know, has hurt you or that you're grieving about. The best advice that I can give to someone is to, you know, just make sure you grieve. Like, don't just go and like throw yourself into something that's not, you know, helping you heal, because if you don't heal, like anything that will remind you of that can trigger you. Like, you know, for a while when I saw pregnant women, it would bother me. Mm-hmm. And when I saw small babies, it will bother me. Like I can now see a pregnant woman, say congratulations, see a small baby. And that's how I know that I'm healing and I'm still in this process and I'm still grieving. But I just learned how to deal with it. And each day is different. So like, there's no wrong or right way to do it. You just have to go through it. And, you know, losing my son was something that's obviously totally unexpected because I had a, you know, healthy, I knew I was high risk pregnancy, but it was a healthy pregnancy up until the point that, you know, I had a uterine rupture. And so I had to like, just change my narrative of like asking God, like, why me? And to saying like, what are you trying to show me from this situation? All things work together for the good. We may not like it as we're going through it, but I do believe that there's always promise on the other side of your grief. And there's always a gift on the other side of your grief, but you can't sit there. You have to actually put action behind it and go find out like, what is the purpose and the promise behind this? For me, I feel like my purpose behind this was becoming closer to God because I didn't grow up in church. You know, I obviously believed in God and believed in Jesus Christ, but I didn't have a relationship. Out of everything that God puts us through, he does everything for his glory. So out of everything, that was the number one thing that came from this was that now I'm very vocal about my faith because I know God brought me through a very dark place in my life. And I am always speaking his praises and always giving him glory. And that's really what we're here on earth to do is to glorify him because he wants all the glory. And so if out of anything, that was the beauty and pain. And once I decided to surrender, God also gave me revelation and vision to create this brand and to go on social media and to talk about hair. So I didn't like throw myself into work immediately. Like I got my life right with God first and then God gave me this vision and it was a way for me to creatively express myself and to like manage my grief as well. And something beautiful came out of that.
You know, of course, hindsight is 20/20 for a lot of people, but I think it provides such a level of, you know, peace for people to know there's something on the other side, but also a really great, you know, reminder that when you do surrender, that is when things like your creative ideas can come to you. Because when you're pushing at it and begging for it and constantly asking the like, why me? That doesn't get you anywhere. You know, you've got to remind yourself that like God put you here for a reason, but you've got to listen for that reason, you know?
Yeah.
And so I really love that story. And so I'd love to hear then more when once you had received this vision, what did that really feel like? And then how did you, you know, decide to take the leap? And I know you quit your job when you had what, 500 followers was it on Instagram? And went all in on everything. Like, tell me more about that, that, you know, the birth of this.
Yeah. So, I mean, in the beginning, to your point, like, yes, I had about 500 followers. So didn't have a huge audience, but I had a very engaged audience. So sometimes it's not always about like the quantity, but like the quality of the people that are following you. And people that were following me, even though it was small, they were very engaged with this journey. I felt that I was speaking to women that looked like me that also shared some of the same like problems. So I was really just problem solving and providing solutions for women that had curly hair. And I was really just serving my community. And even in the early days, like I had to do a lot of things from customer service, actually pumping and packing the products, marketing, social media content creation. Like I was doing all of that. My husband and I, we were just out there just like grinding. And I really just decided to, you know, put like 1,000% of my all and everything. Because at that time, when I first started, I was still working as a nurse. So I was seeing patients in the daytime, pick up my kids from school, you know, after school, like be a mom. And then once they go to sleep, I would work on the company. And I'm like, what if I actually had like a whole full day and like full-time hours to like dedicate to this? Like I can really like take this thing to the next level. And I remember telling my husband that, you know, I wanted to like consider like leaving my nursing career. And he was like, what do you mean you're gonna leave your nursing career? Like you worked so hard to become a nurse. Like you're not going to do that. And I said, well, yes, I am. I'm going to leave. So I actually typed up my resignation letter and I hung it in my closet and I signed it. And so I looked at that resignation letter every single day. I started the company in May, typed up my resignation letter, like very shortly after that. I was able to leave my job in October and I dated it for November. So 1 month shy of like what I actually put out to God in the
That's atmosphere. Something you still do is like putting out that, like that
Absolutely.
Sort of.
Absolutely. And I teach my kids. I teach my kids that too. And, you know, because it's like from my mouth to God's ears. And, you know, one of my favorite scriptures is write the vision and make it plain. And faith without works is dead. Like you have to write the vision, make it plain, hold God accountable to what he tells us to do. It's not a wish. I didn't make a wish and say like, oh, I wish that this has happened. Like I actually put the work in. So you can't just think that you're going to write things down and it's going to happen. Like God is not a genie, right?
Yeah.
We have to actually put the work in as well too. And so I put the work in and I was able to leave my job. And so I teach my kids like write it down, make it plain, but actually do the work.
Absolutely. And something that my mom loves early childhood, something she says is don't steal the struggle. And sometimes you need that. You can't just ask God to, you know, make everything go away. Like that 6 month period when you were working and like working towards something, I'm sure now you look back and like, yes, it was a hard time, but it's a rewarding time where you learn a lot and you have to get creative. You start to, you know, really expand your business and learn so much. So that is a really amazing lesson for people who are starting to grow right now. Are there other things in those early days that you did that most people wouldn't do?
I feel like most people wouldn't even just take the risk.
Yeah, most people
like,
really would.
Most
yeah.
people are not going to like just, especially where I come from, people that had like stable careers, stable environments, they were making decent money. Like they're not going to even leave what was so like sweet for them or secure for them to like just say, okay, I have this passion. I have this dream. I'm going to actually go for it. Some people don't even start. And the saying of like, where do you find most dreams? In the graveyard. Because not a lot of people pursue their dreams. They die with a dream that was never manifested in their heart. And I'm like, I don't want that to be me. So I think that's what, you know, number one for me.
Absolutely. I think that's, I think when you have that clarity and that connection to God too, it can really help you even in moments where you do get stressed out, which I'm sure there were many of because you bootstrapped until 2020, if I'm correct, which is a very big undertaking for such a massive business. So for anyone who's like experiencing that, like, could you tell us like the truth of what that was like for so many years and how you managed it and like what kept you from quitting?
Yeah. So bootstrapping is very interesting. It's not as pretty and glamorous as it sounds.
No, it's not.
Yeah. You know, it's like lots of sacrifice, lots of blood, sweat, and tears. You have to make some money and you have to have sales to come in so you can actually take that money and reinvest that back into the business. And so we were like grinding every day. Like we had sales every single day. Like there was not a day that we had not had sales online. And sometimes with like new companies, one day you may get a sale, the next day you may not get a sale. But we were like adamant of making sure that we were always showing up online. We were always marketing and we were always like bringing money in so we can like now take that money and order more product. I mean, there are times where we had customers waiting about 2 weeks for their packages because we didn't have the funding to like buy the product to replenish. So we would have to wait to get sales in. And then that just ruins the customer experience. And so not a lot of people are going to stick that out because that's not the pretty side of it. Like your customers are angry. You still have to show up with a smile on your face every single day. You still have to serve the women and you still have to make sure that they are receiving their product. And you still have to deal with the manufacturers and the vendors on the other end that are asking for like, where's their payment? And you don't have the funds to pay it. So, you know, and I think nowadays, because the world is so much faster and because everything is lightning speed, I'm not even sure like that will work because no customers want to wait 2 weeks for their products. Like, I think we were able to get away with it because, you know, things were now like emerging as, you know, Amazon was still emerging as, you know, 2-day shipping, but the standard has changed and the consumer behavior is always changing, always evolving. And quite frankly, I don't think that we would have survived being able to ship like that in this day and age. Again, that's why I said the joys of bootstrapping is not really joyous or glamorous, but it's a part of the process.
Absolutely. And so then when you did eventually raise investment, it was very impressive. I mean, like, really it was. So can you walk us through how did that come about when you had been doing this for, you know, been in the trenches for so long? What made you say we have a product that like we're going to take on investment now?
Yeah. So we decided to take on investment when we were actually not profitable and we were actually like in trouble and we needed the money. When we were like growing in, and obviously we bootstrapped ourselves out of bootstrapping. We grew out of being able to bootstrap because, you know, the money was starting to get tight. Then we had entered into retail and, you know, retail cuts into your margins as well. And so we had to really double down and figure out like how to continue supporting the growth. So our initial thing was taking a line of credit from the bank. So we took a line of credit. And of course, we did not have the right mentorship, not the right people that were giving us the right advice and guiding us. So we were using our line of credit incorrectly. We were using it for marketing and it should have been for inventory. But hence, you know, learning lesson. And so we came to the point where like the banks were like knocking on our doors, like, okay, when are we going to, like, we want our money back. Like, we're going to call your line due, in which they actually did. And so we were, not profitable. We were like cash strapped. I remember when we were trying to get investments, like we had so many investors tell us no. And finally the investor that gave us an opportunity, because on the outside we were growing exponentially. Like we were just, the company looked beautiful. So nobody knew that we were having financial struggles. But then when you look at our books, because we also had the wrong accountant, the accountants were like doing our books incorrectly. So we thought we had more money coming in than we actually did. The investor that invested in us as a friends and family round was Richard Lou Dennis with New Voices, his fund. And because he believed in our vision and he saw like how the brand was performing on the upside, you know, for us, it was just like, okay, I'm going to help you guys because I can see the opportunity. And it's just like learning lessons, growing pains. Like he really saw our problems as just growing pains. And obviously he had been through the same thing himself. And he also believed in us as entrepreneurs because we were so driven and so ambitious, and he knew that we would put the work in. So he ended up being our first friends and family investor, and that investment went amazing. And he didn't even take a huge percentage. Like the first investor that we were talking to actually wanted 40% of our company. And that was like insane to me because I knew that my company was going to, you know, have more value. And I knew that he was taking advantage of us. But, you know, when one door closes, don't try to crack that door open, leave it closed, because God has something better in store for you. And that's exactly what happened. So New Voices ended up taking a very small percentage, invested in our company. That's allowed us to get in a profitable state. That was actually during COVID. When we took that investment, COVID happened. I mean, we probably closed, let's say it was February 16th.
No way.
Of 2020. Wow. The world shut down like March 18th. In 2020.
What effect did that have on your business? I know it's different for every type of company. What effect did that have on you guys?
Yeah. So I know it was like a crazy time for the world, but our company did extremely well. But when it first happened, I'm like, okay, we took all this money. Like, what do we do with it?
That's so scary. And I
remember, it was very scary. And I remember calling him and getting some advice. And he was like, just keep your foot on the gas pedal, keep marketing. I'm like, oh, okay. So that's exactly what I did. Like, even though it was scary, uncertain, and the way that we like marketed to our consumers had to shift, we had to pivot. When we did that pivot, we saw 4x growth. And so the company grew so much and we were so profitable. And I remember the prior year before that, we had such a hard time raising funds that I said, okay, now we're in a good state. Now we have the leverage. Now we can negotiate how we want to negotiate. And I think it's time to raise because now I know that I want to, you know, my plan and goal was to eventually have an exit and be acquired. And I had to back into that plan. And I knew one of the ways to have a successful exit was to take on private equity and, you know, help have them come along and help us build infrastructure and really like just amplify what we were already doing great. And so that's what we did. And when we did the private equity raise, because we were so profitable and we were attractive asset, we had so many private equity firms that were like chomping at the bits trying to be a part of Mayo because we had did something remarkable. And that was like a good feeling coming from a place of like, you know, everybody's telling us no to like, now everybody wants you and now you get to dictate the rules. It was like, yeah, I really did that.
That is a transformative experience. And like, I'm also curious, like you must have really had to be okay with uncertainty, like, and like with being uncomfortable because you were going through that a lot in those moments. And so what do you think gave you that strength to be like, it's all going to work out? Was it your faith or was it your partner? Like, tell me more about that.
Definitely my faith. And, you know, for me, my appetite for risk probably increased. Again, I just have I had a different perspective on life and I'm like, what do I have to lose? Like, let's go for it. Like, you know, this is something that I'm building and I know that I have done a great job. I started to do a really great job of surrounding myself with the right people, knowledgeable people. And I was like a sponge. I was learning so much. And I just learned about like, this is the roadmap. This is the path. This is how you do it. And for me, it was like, you got to strike when the iron is hot. Because you never know when a private equity firm is going to be interested in you. You never know when a strategic partner is going to be interested in you. And when you have momentum and you know you have built something sweet, you got to go for it. And that was like my mentality. So I think just my level of like taking risk was like, I'm going to just go for it. And I think that's what also makes me, you know, a good entrepreneur is like, you have to have some type of risk. I would say calculated risk.
Calculated risk.
Yeah. Take calculated risk and be very thoughtful and strategic, but know what you want. And I knew what I wanted.
Absolutely. And even having that vision of wanting to exit at some point, it must have been like during that time when you were getting the no's from a lot of investors, you probably saw a lot of gaps there. And then being able to fill those and create leverage after is a learning experience in itself and so important. So once you became the first Black woman to raise a 9-figure non-controlling investment, how did you even learn that was possible? Were you just reaching out to people and asking a lot of questions or were you doing a lot of research on your own? I think that is a really incredible demonstration of having high agency is doing all that learning. But a lot of people get a little stuck in like, oh, I don't know all the answers to these questions. What do I do? So how did you go about learning how to even build that type of structure and even what private equity could do for your business?
Yeah, so I would say I am a continuous student of life. I love learning. I love discovering new things and learning how things work. And another thing that I do is like, I study people. I'm very observant. I mean, my background is in nursing. I was taught to learn how to assess people and then treat. And like, I take that, it's so ingrained in me. I think that skill set is still how I operate today. Like my husband says, I probably overly assess, but I mean, I can't help it. And that same muscle of my mind that I'm using is the same muscle that allows me to create, right? And to be innovative. I like to study people and I like to study their stories. They may not necessarily be a mentor that I can reach out and ask questions, but I guarantee you, I will probably watch every podcast, every interview, show up at every event that they're doing, that they're talking, and I would just gather nuggets from each conversation that I've studied from that person. And I compile all of that together from all of the different people that I learn from, and I extract what I feel works for me. And then I apply that advice in addition to getting out there and networking and meeting people and asking a lot of questions. And so I actually don't want to be the smartest person in my circle. I would rather sit at a table and listen to everyone around me talk versus me contributing to that conversation, because I learned so much by just sitting and listening. And then I go home and I research. My husband says I always go down a rabbit hole, but that's me learning and being excited about things. And that's what I was able to do about like learning how private equity can help build infrastructure and help us find like the right people, C-suite executives, and how they actually prepare. We like to say prepare the meal for you to be more attractive to a strategic. And not necessarily, you don't always have to go to private equity route. You can go straight to a strategic, right? Or you can sell to a private equity. But I knew that I wanted to maximize the highest value for my company. And in order for me to do that, this was the route that I wanted to take. This was just for me just asking questions from like my mentors, Richelieu, and, you know, his team, and seeing also what worked in this industry and also what didn't work, because I was also able to witness that there were brands that may have started around the same time or may have been in business longer and were not really progressing. And then, you know, I would see someone like a Rich actually progressing, and I'm like, okay, I want to learn from you and I want to do it better. So I just like to surround myself with like smart people and not be afraid. Like, I'm humble enough to say, like, I don't know, help me do this. And I'm going to ask a lot of questions. And sometimes I don't even know what questions to ask. So that's why I'm always like all for like listening and observing.
That's really so refreshing. And I think such a great lesson for people to take with them about, it's not always about being the most powerful person in the room or showing up with the most to say. It's about being a sponge, a lifelong sponge. And I think many of the most successful women, I think, in the world adopt that mindset as well. And I think that it's a really important to learn. And like, that can lead you into, you know, being the person who did start out and then had the best, you know, result at the end of those few years.
If you're listening to this show, you're an ambitious woman, and you probably already know how to do a lot. You know how to perform, you know how to achieve, you know how to look like you have it all together. However, you might not know how to slow down for long enough to ask the question, is this life actually aligned with the one that I say that I want? And that is why I created The Alignment Edit. It's a live in-person workshop that helps ambitious material girls go from chaotic ambition to intentional ambition. We get together for a couple hours to audit your current life and identify the assumptions that are quietly holding you back. We help you redirect your ambition towards something that actually feels good and sustainable. This is not a hustle seminar or a how to fix your life boot camp. It's sort of a reset. And after that, we vision board, drink wine, and bond over the realities of being an ambitious material girl. If you're tired of doing everything but still feeling a little bit off, this is your edit. For the latest Alignment Edit tickets, visit airbnb.com/AlexisBarber. I can't wait to meet you. Let's take this offline.
When it comes to the founders that are going to come after you, I know you care so much about, you know, business in our community and everything. And when you announced the P&G acquisition, Black Twitter, I remember Black Twitter exploding at that time. But what was it like to sit with that reaction, especially knowing how much you sacrificed to be there and how much you know that you care about your community?
Yeah. So to be honest with you, I actually tuned out the noise when we made the announcement. I didn't go on social media. I don't even have Twitter. So that was a good thing. because for me, it was intentional and purposeful. And I knew it was my purpose, because I knew that this was a conversation that I had with God about my brand. This was something that I journaled about. And no one knows like those deep, intimate conversations. No one truly knows anyone's heart to judge them, right? So that's why we have to, you know, always extend grace. And I know we don't always get it right. But when we ground ourselves and bring it right back to God's word, like, nobody knows anyone's heart intentions. And so I had to really like ground myself in that thought, like, this was something that I prayed on. This is an answered prayer. So anyone that wants to criticize that or try to tear me down, I'm not going to even allow it, because what God has for me, no man can take that away from me, right? And so I just grounded myself in that truth. When I did resurface back to social media and came back to social media life, I had saw that a lot of the responses were positive, because I think that I really took the time to be very transparent with my audience. I've always been very transparent, and I really wanted them to understand why I made this decision and take them on this journey with me, as I've always had. And to also show like the brand is still going to be protected. You know, I'm still going to be leading the vision for the brand. And like, growth doesn't mean we have to sacrifice authenticity, but this is great for our community. And I really took the time to explain like why this is a good thing. And here's why. Like, here's why we created our Mayel Cares, our nonprofit, because we want to do more. Here's why we did this partnership, because we want to be able to have more access to products protects your hair for people that look like us at the show. If we don't have these type of partnerships, we're not going to be able to create generational wealth for our communities. We're not going to have access to more products on the show. So I really wanted to position it to show my community, like, this is also for you. It's not just for, you know, what people may think that an acquisition is for, but my dream was to be a global brand. Mm-hmm. And I knew that, you know, the business had grown to a place of like, it was outgrowing my expertise. And we have to be humble enough as CEOs to say that, like, I've gotten it to this point, but now I want to accelerate. Like, I didn't come from business, right? I was a registered nurse. And a smart entrepreneur knows how to surround themselves with people that are smarter in certain areas that they may not be smart in to help them really execute their vision. So I'm not sitting here saying like, oh, I couldn't have done it by myself. I absolutely could have. But I also wanted help in partnership to help me accelerate my dream even faster. And, you know, I think that that's why as a community, we should celebrate things like this, because it allows us to not leave the brands or the company, but it allows us to take our seat with us and have a seat at the table, at tables that we were necessarily not invited to. And that's really what I wanted our community to understand, because I do want, you know, the next Black entrepreneur to be able to do an even bigger acquisition, right? That's how we continue to get ahead, by having these opportunities.
I really love that you brought this example to the forefront, you know, and gave people this understanding of why this matters. And I know you talk about like, there's a hard line between selling out and selling up, which is a really amazing distinction. And obviously, like, I grew up in the Black community where it was like, oh, like, this person is selling out. But after getting my MBA from Wharton, it's like, no, this is the smartest thing you can possibly do. And for me, like, I had my own company and I bootstrapped it with thinking that same ownership piece. And now I would never like start a company without like a strategic partner or without investment or something like that, because that's not how you build generational wealth, you know. And it creates an unnecessary suffering, I think, that we often think that we have to experience in order to be, you know, entrepreneurs, which can be really difficult. But I also want to hear a little bit more about the nonprofit and how you were able to bring that into the discussion. Was that something that you negotiated and you always had a vision for?
Yeah, absolutely. Giving back has always been the heart of everything that we do, like invested in our community. I think it was important for us to know that this community has supported us. So like, how do we make sure that we give back to the community that has gotten us here? And as we sat down and negotiated at the table, it was like, okay, it's great that you want to, you know, acquire us, but what can you do for this community that we serve? And they made a commitment without us even asking of like, they're going to commit, you know, $10 million to our Myo Cares. Like, that was a part of the proposal that was sent over. And when my husband and I saw this, we were just like, wow, like, this is an amazing gesture to say, you know what, like, we're not just committed to help and accelerate your brand, we're also committed to seeing your community grow, because we know how passionate you are about the community. So we're going to support any of your endeavors. So like, our Myo Cares, it really supports initiatives that uplift, you know, teens and tweens. We actually started at the high school that Melvin and I attended with some of our programs. We created a My Mental Mindset program, and we're targeting mental health in underserved communities and schools. And our goal is to have two mental health therapists in each school and the districts that we're serving in those underserved, underprivileged areas, because you have kids that are going to school that don't have basic necessities. Right. How can they focus on school? They're going to school and they have to get back home to take care of their 5-6 brothers and sisters because their mom is at work. Like, the loads and the stress that some of these kids are faced with, they shouldn't have to carry these loads. So our goal is to help them with their mental health and give them the resources and the tools that they need so we can then set them up for a brighter future.
That's amazing. And I absolutely applaud the commitment to mental health, particularly because that's an often overlooked part, especially in our underserved communities, that when you don't have the tools to deal with your circumstances mentally, that can exasperate so many problems and keep so many people from realizing their futures and their dreams. When I'm talking to you now, I hear this very strong and powerful woman who has been, has a vision for both your career, for your, the people that you want to serve, and for the community that you've brought up. But I'm curious on this like rise that you've had from being a bootstrapped entrepreneur that was like working a full-time job and being a mom to being someone who is very prominent in your community and has a lot of financial access, just the opportunities that you have now that you work with P&G. I am really curious internally in your mind, how did you go from that jump of being, whether it was the underdog or, you know, being new to business, to being an authority and mentally take, being okay with taking up space and being a powerful woman?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I really just trusted in my faith, and I knew that God blessed me with this moment. He put me in this time frame for a specific reason. And I really had to focus on being the light where I'm at, even in a world that can appear to be so dark. Like, I try to really focus on what is it that I can do to be impactful and to serve my community. And if that comes with, you know, a level of authority, then I'm going to own it and I'm going to walk in that purpose because He's blessed me with that. I feel that God also uses the least of us, because I never see myself in this light. I wasn't shy, but I was a very reserved, like, child growing up. I mean, I'm still pretty reserved now. I'm not the most talkative person. So to now be in positions where, like, I'm being on panels and I'm talking, I'm doing podcasts and, you know, I'm doing lives and, you know, really engaging with people and going to events and being this talkative person that I never saw for myself. It's just like, wow, like, to see how God has used me in this position of building my Yale, for me, it's like really remarkable, like how He has positioned me. And so for me, it's like, I don't want to disappoint my calling and the calling that He has placed on my life. So I'm going to get out of my own way and stop telling myself all of these negative thoughts that I can't do it, that I'm not qualified. Because even though in my mind, I may not be qualified, but I know that He's qualified me for this role. And so for me, I'm going to show up because God put me on this planet to do exactly what I'm doing.
It's really like a masterclass in humility being your driver. Disappointment for people comes from the fact that they don't feel like proud of themselves, or they're very focused on the external. But from what I've heard, the through line here has really been a focus on building an excellent business, providing an excellent product, and having a really engaged and meaningful community. And that has created so many ripple effects, of course, based on just your success and how that inspires people, but also, you know, in terms of the product and the community that you serve. And so I really am inspired by that. And I think a lot of people will really resonate with that. But I'm also curious about the hard parts or the negative like thoughts that you have that you had to overcome, because as a young entrepreneur myself, I think my biggest, you know, problem is myself. It's like the negative thoughts that, you know, continue to come on a loop or something like, and things like that. So I'm curious for you, since oftentimes Black women building publicly, we get hit with like a lot of controversy. I mean, we've been seeing the Hanifa discussion. We've been seeing so much happen with other Black female founders. For someone who's building a new brand right now, or who's in those early stages and is afraid of that controversy, or is dealing with a lot of those negative thoughts, what would you recommend for them to do? Or how would you recommend that they get closer to their calling or closer to God in the way that you did?
Yeah, so negative thoughts is something that, you know, I think every human being on this earth deals with. How I deal with negative thoughts is to replace it with a scripture, God's word, and to not come in agreement with that thought. So if a thought or an intrusive thoughts comes to mind, you have to stop that thought in its tracks and say, I am not in agreement with this. This thought does not have any power over me or my mind. I'm going to stop this thought in its traps. And if you have to speak scripture, like I speak scripture, I will resist the devil and he will flee from me. That helps keep me grounded. And to know that, like, you have to know the world that we live in. We are in a very fast-paced world. On social media, you're not just dealing with global news, good news, bad news that is coming at you 24/7. You're also dealing with commentary. You're dealing with opinions. You're dealing with people that are arguing back and forth. Like, it is a lot to take in. And the thing is, like, our human brain was never created to absorb and receive all of that information at one time. So when you think about, like, even back in ancient times, like every era, you know, has their own trials and tribulation. Every era goes through their own set of trouble. Even when we were growing up in the 80s, I don't know how old you are, but me, I was born in the 80s. But growing up, you only knew what was going on in your small community. You didn't have access to everything being thrown at you across the entire world. So that is a lot to process. We were not designed to process information like that. So I think it's like, number one, knowing how your brain works, knowing that sometimes you just got to pull yourself back. And for me, like, I set limits on when I scroll. Like, I try not to doom scroll. I also try to not even comment. People barely see me commenting on other people's posts because I really just try to, like, stay away. I like pictures and I'll comment every now and then, but I really try to limit how much I am, like, engaging on social media, because the way that social media is set up, it is set up to keep you on there forever, right? Yeah. They want you to engage. And when they see something that you engage with, the algorithm keeps showing you stuff like that over and over again. So let's say if you see something bad that happened and you're reading about it and you start reading the comments, now the algorithm is going to send you more information on the same thing you read. Everything is just happening all at once when really it's not. That's not our reality. So I just encourage people to take breaks from social media. I obviously am working on social media. That's part of, like, what I do. But I make sure that when I go on there, I'm intentional about how I scroll and I get off, so I'm not falling into the doom scrolling trap, because that's exactly what they want from you. So I know I said a lot, but that's something that I'm, like, super passionate about, so for, like, important mental health, sanity reasons. And this is also what, like, I try to teach kids, is, but my kids don't even listen to me either. Like, they're going to have to come to their own, you know, and get off of social media. But, like, you're their little brains, you can't process all of that. If we can't process it, you can't process it.
Especially those little brains. You're so right.
Yeah. So I just, like, really, I'm big on, like, understanding why things are set up the way that it's set up and not letting it control you. Even the news, like, when we were younger, the news came on, like, once a day. Now the news is coming on all day, constant headlines, and that we cannot take that. So I don't watch news. I'm to know enough of what's going on, but I only need to watch it one time, but I don't need to keep seeing it over and over again, because it's not good for my mental health. So that's just, I can go down a rabbit hole on it.
I'm the same way. I preach to my audience that same thing. That's like, you actually do have control over your algorithm. Like, the things that you choose to engage with, it's not just happening to you. It's like, whatever you engage with will come back. So choose to engage in positive content. Choose to engage with things that are going to teach you something rather than the rage bait that's out there, you know? But yeah, it's like, it's so hard, and it really does affect a lot of people, especially young kids' mental health. So I think that's such a good reminder for people, like, you have agency, and try to, you know, encourage the positive things you're seeing online. I am curious, if you mentioned journaling. We love journaling on the show. We have a guided journal. So is that something that you also do for your mental health? And are there other, like, practices that you have that are sort of non-negotiables to sort of stay in your own zone?
Yeah, absolutely. Journaling is great for my mental health. I don't do it every day. I do it when I feel the pressure that I need to. Because sometimes, and, you know, dealing with what I deal with, sometimes people that are in my, like, close immediate circle may not necessarily be able to relate to a lot of things. Not all of my friends are entrepreneurs, right? Yes. And my journal for me is a way to have, like, a brain dump, an outlet for me to have a conversation with God, to, like, write down my prayers. And if I just have information overload and I just need to, like, reorganize my thoughts and, like, get back in alignment, I will go and journal to get myself back on track. So it's usually when I'm feeling, like, overwhelmed, if I feel out of alignment and I need some clarity, I'll go write and journal, and I'll just sit there and wait, and God will speak to me. And also write down, like, my visions and my dreams. Because again, I go right back to the scripture that I mentioned earlier. So it's a very cathartic, like, outlet for me to just sit and journal. I feel so great after I do it.
Right. And I love what you said, is, like, God always has an answer as long as you're, like, listening for it, I think. think. Yeah, and ready to receive it. So, all right, I am curious now that I'd love to get into your new era since we are at the end of our time here about your new collection that just dropped. I went to Hair by Susie and she used it on my hair. And when I tell you, I had like, for the first time in my life, dry scalp this winter because it's been brutal here in New York.
I heard, yes.
Oh, yes. And I was like, this came at the perfect time and I went and I have not had a dry scalp since. So tell us all about it and everything that you put into it.
Yeah. So, I mean, this collection, our Lavender and Lychee collection, it was designed solely for that to address, you know, some of the scalp issues that we face as Black women, multicultural women, and dealing with like itchiness, dryness, flakes, prolonged protective styles. You know, we wear a lot of wigs, weaves, clip-ins, sew-ins. And when you go to like select a dandruff shampoo, they're very stripping, they're very drying to our hair. And I'm like, you know, who's speaking to us? Like, we also have scalp issues. And, you know, with Mael, for us, scalp is the foundation of healthy hair. Like, that's always what we've spoken about. That's always what we've educated our maidens about. And we want a shampoo. And I hear consumers saying, because I do a lot of social listening, that like, where's the shampoo that's for us that can tackle our dryness, itchiness, flaky scalps, but not strip our hair, that's not drying, that's actually moisturizing. So that's where the lavender and lychee came to be. And, you know, lavender is a really great ingredient for a dry, itchy scalp because it's very calming. It's very soothing, and it has major anti-inflammatory properties. So when we go to select our ingredients, we're very intentional and thoughtful about, like, you know, selecting ingredients that serve our scalp and our hair well. Like, lychee is a great antioxidant for scalp care. And so we need all of the nice juices and berries that help us have a healthy base so our hair can truly thrive in a healthy scalp environment.
Well, you mentioned doing a lot of social listening. So this is something, you seem to be very involved in the product development here. So I'm curious, like, can you walk us through how you went through that process of like, okay, I'm noticing people are needing this. And then you start to look at the ingredients and things like that.
You know, number one, like when we create a product line, even though it seems like it happens overnight, it can take a year or sometimes even longer to actually create this product collection. So like our mavens need to know that this is like very time intentional. Like we really put some thought and strategy behind understanding like her needs. Like we never want to put products out there that, you know, we feel she wants. We want to be intentional about understanding what her problems are and like, how do we solve her problems? And so as when I talked about like intentionally being on social media, like I'm on the hair blogs, I am on like our page, looking at the comments, you know, reading the DMs that people are sending me and seeing like, you know, what are the different problems? And if they're not specifically talking on our page about their hair needs or problems, because sometimes our customers will vocally say like, I need you to create this. And if enough people are saying that, I will take that back to our team and say, hey, people are asking for this. You know, now that we have partnership with P&G, we have access to even a scientific approach. We have access to Black scientists. We also have access to really understanding consumer data and behavior because they have those studies that, you know, we didn't have access to when we were, you know, Mael before the partnership, right? So being able to complement and mirror, you know, the level of data and also social listening. And then also, you know, what we were already doing naturally, understanding our consumer and selecting ingredients based off of that. But now we can go even deeper and understand from a scientific perspective, like, how does this make the hair feel? Like, how is the customer going to behave when she's doing her self-care day? Like, what are these ingredients and how are they actually beneficial for the scalp? So we're just going to layer deeper with bringing her, you know, the best research and the best ingredients and also sourcing it from the best sourcing manufacturers so we can give her the greatest. And that's exactly what goes into this process. So the process is still the same, you know, even with the partnership with P&G, but now it's just elevated process with even stricter processes and procedures and more higher intelligence behind the data that supports what we're already doing.
That's really wonderful. And I think also an excellent example of, you know, what it looks like to scale your business and the resources that come with that. And I think people will really appreciate hearing how much and will trust a lot more. You know, we're not just launching a product because we're launching a product. Like, this is what we get to put in this. And we know it solves a real problem, because you're not going to invest in a product that doesn't solve a real problem for people.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I really love hearing that. And from personal experience, I absolutely love it. Do you have a favorite product in the collection?
Out of the entire Mayo collection?
Out of the new one. Because I know you can't do one out of the whole collection, but out of your new collection, what's your favorite?
Yeah. So I'm definitely like a conditioner girly. Like, I love conditioners just because I just really love like what conditioners are intended to do, provide moisture and slip and help with detangling properties, and then like how my hair feels after it. So the Lavender and Lychee conditioner is like A1, but I'm also like a conditioner girly. So if I had to choose, it would be the conditioner.
Okay. Good to know. Yeah. Susie also loved it. The conditioner as well. Okay, so before we move into our Material Girl moment, which is our little end of show rapid fire moment, I'm curious what's next for you and what's next for your brand?
Yeah, so what's next for me? So I'm really tapping into the health and wellness space. I think that like, no matter what I do, my nursing career always comes back full circle. I feel like I utilize my nursing career and Mayel and developing hair products and understanding the science behind this, but I really want to do it in an even bigger way with helping our community, especially the Black community, understand longevity science and how to really amplify your health for longevity, understand like biomarkers, preventative disease, because I also am very passionate that I feel that here in our country, it's not about preventative, it's about treating. Because again, I learned that in school as well too, but I really want to reverse that narrative and teach people how to, you know, prevent diseases. Just because hypertension runs in your bloodline or diabetes runs in your bloodline, those are actually reversible. And here's how we can help reverse some of those diseases. And I feel like that education needs to be heavily put in our community. So my husband and I have started a new venture called Win Athletics, which is a fitness facility and will also be like a longevity science hub as well.
Wonderful. That is such an important thing. I feel like also in the Black community, when it comes to health and wellness, we often get left behind in that conversation. So I'm really happy that you're focusing on that. All right. Well, I'd like to close the show with a little rapid fire moment with a couple of our favorite things. And then we can figure out where everyone can come and find you. So, All right, let's get started. What's your favorite lip combo right now?
I'm so like old school. So it's a brown liner, a little pink shade of lipstick and some lip gloss.
Love it. What's one thing that is always in your bag?
One thing that is always in my bag are my AirPods. Like, I feel like I can't live without my AirPods.
So real. Me neither. And speaking of that, what are you listening to lately?
So what I'm listening to are a lot of podcasts. I've really been listening to like Michelle Obama's podcast. I love her podcast. Also Emma Greed. I'm also an audiobook reader as well too.
Me too. What's the latest book you've read? Or what are you reading right now?
So right now, I'll tell you right now because it's actually on my phone. Because I forgot the title. But it is The Rules of Fortune.
The Rules of Fortune. Okay.
Yeah, that's like my fantasy. I like to read a lot of fantasy like books because it kind of like helps me like escape.
Yeah. And you need that because you can't only be consuming business when you're life is the business.
Exactly.
Do you have a signature accessory?
A signature accessory is my little pouch. It's a Mugler. I actually have it on now. But it's like always with me because it's so convenient. I can just throw stuff in there and I have to carry a big purse around like on the days that I'm like ripping and running.
Mm-hmm. Efficiency. I love that. Yeah. I love that. What is one wellness habit that keeps you sane?
Working out.
Mm-hmm. So true. I like think people really underestimate it, but it really does keep you sane.
Absolutely. I haven't worked out in 2 days and I'm like, I missed the gym. I need it.
No, literally, like when there's a day I don't work out and I like inevitably get anxious or like cry about something, I'm like, oh, I didn't move my body. Very necessary. I know this one's hard, but what is the best book you've ever read?
That's hard. Because there's so many good books, but I'm going to have to say the Bible.
That's what I like to hear. Perfect. You can get all the knowledge you need right in there.
Over and over again, you're always going to get a different interpretation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Do you have a hot take about being an ambitious woman?
A hot take about being an ambitious woman? I would say my hot take is, you know, never lose your authenticity or your empathy. Like, we don't have to take on a man's role to get things done. We can still do things being our feminine selves.
Absolutely. I think we need that reminder. I love it. All right. Do you prefer coffee or matcha?
Coffee.
Same girl. Okay. All right. The last question that I like to ask everyone who comes on the show is to finish this sentence with something that you want other women to know. You are too smart for
any man to walk all over you.
Exactly. Exactly. And period. That's what
my
we
girl said. So I'm like, that's the first thing that comes to mind. I tell them all the time, you're too smart to let these guys manipulate you.
Exactly. Well, that's a wonderful way for us to end. Okay. Where can everyone find you? Where can everyone find the collection? Give us the whole rundown.
Yes. So you can find our collection at your retail stores, on our website, myyellorganics.com. Also, you can follow us at myyellorganics and also my personal page at Exquisimo.
Amazing. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to another episode of Too Smart for This. Make sure you're subscribed to our Substack and follow us on Instagram and TikTok at Too Collective. Don't be stupid. Listen to Too Smart for This.